Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore doing the news and co-hosting today. I'm really glad that we're all together
we're all
again. And Lamia is here teching for us today. We have a very packed show. I'll give you a brief introduction and then we'll go into news with Rob. I guess at about 11:15, we'll connect with Ray from the group Skinned, which is a BC animal protection group, and she's going to tell us about how their group, Skinned, was able to pressure famous players to stop their advertising for the Fur Council of Canada and under other independent furriers. And we're also going to find out more about the fur industry in Canada and also about the European fur industry, which Ray pointed out to me yesterday was essential to talk about if you want to talk about the Canadian industry. They're very much linked. So we're going to find out about the fur industry, and considering it is quite cold outside, I'm sure a lot of people are bringing out their furs, and if you want to find out more where those furs came from, then please stay tuned. We are also going to hear from Pradeep Kumar Nath, who is the president and founder of the Visakha SPCA. We weren't able to connect with him last week. Hopefully we are going to be able to hear from him this week about some of the rescue efforts they're doing on the east coast of India right now to help out with the situation with the tsunami disaster. And then in the last portion of the hour, we're going to hear from Leslie Fox, and she's going to tell us all about their campaign that it's really a support group, which I found kind of interesting. It's a support group for students called Frogs Are Cool, which helps students in, I would assume, high school, but probably also junior high, help refusing to dissect. And this group claims that it's part of exercising their rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms for students to be able to find alternatives to dissection. And we're going to find out more about dissection as well. But before we do that, we're going to hear some news from Rob Moore.
Thanks, Lauren. I'm excited about that because frogs are cool. In this week's news, bird stomping is illegal unless you work for KFC. The U.S. Navy keeps killing whales, and a vegetarian philanthropist spreads the love. But first, this from Reuters. The gruesome task of retrieving the bodies of tsunami victims has turned many Thai rescue workers vegetarian, the Matashan newspaper said on last Friday. Our operations in the first days weren't going smoothly, said Chachawan Suthiaran in Khao Lak, where about 4,000 people were killed on December 26th. After we turned to vegetarian food and lighting joss sticks to the spirits asking for help, the job has become much easier, he said. Matashan said vegetarian food was all the rage in one nearby village where a makeshift relief kitchen produced about 1,000 boxes of meatless food a day. A newspaper quoted a survivor as saying that the smell of death had put her off meat. So that's not really a good news story about vegetarianism, just more about how the strange connection between death and life actually connects you with what you're eating. Next from Canoe News, regarding mad cow disease and demonstrating the kind of misguided leadership he's become notorious for, Ralph Klein said humans would have to, quote, eat 10 billion meals of brains, spinal cords, ganglia, eyeballs, and tonsils to get the disease. He said he has been challenged before when he has told this anecdote with its astronomical figures, but that he stands by his opinion on the risk to humans, which he described again as, quote, so minimal. So the people who have died from this disease around the world, does he think they ate 10 billion meals of brains and eyeballs? I'm not sure how he got elected in the first place. Next from the Associated Press, former workers at a chicken processing plant who were caught on tape allegedly kicking, stomping, and slamming chickens against the wall won't face criminal charges, a prosecutor said. Ginny Conley, head of a state prosecutor's organization, said that while the incident at the Pilgrim's Pride plant in Moorfield was disturbing, it doesn't warrant criminal charges because, quote, these were chickens in a slaughterhouse, end quote. The plant serves as a supplier to Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants. It needs to be handled more on a regulatory end than prosecuting someone criminally, she said. And yet, from KOTV.com, a Bartlesville man will spend 18 months in the state prison for stomping a bird to death. Clarence Billingsley was sentenced last week after pleading guilty last October to a charge of animal cruelty. Bartlesville police say they were called to Billingsley's apartment last August to investigate a report of a man destroying his apartment. The officers say they saw a yellow cockatiel lying in the grass, unable to move, and when they told Billingsley it needed attention, he stomped it with his foot. The officers say Billingsley then said he had bought the bird for his girlfriend and could do whatever he wanted with it. But according to the previous story, it's okay to stomp on birds as long as you're behind a certain wall called a slaughterhouse. Anyway, next from the Environment News Service, the U.S. Navy has ordered its vessel commanders to exercise greater caution when operating in the migratory corridors of the North Atlantic right whale, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility has learned. They are also called PIER. This temporary measure follows the death of four endangered right whales, including two pregnant females, in little more than a month. One of those pregnant females, whose unborn calf was almost at full term, was rammed by a Navy ship outside the entrance to Chesapeake Bay, PIER said last Thursday. The single biggest known source of whale strikes is U.S. Navy ships, which are more numerous and travel faster than commercial vessels. In an email to PIER, the public affairs officer for the U.S. Fleet Forces Command wrote that the Navy had adopted, quote, amplified guidance that does include information to raise awareness of right whale migration in the mid-Atlantic during certain times of the year, end quote. Hunted almost to extinction before a whaling moratorium was established in 1986 by the International Whaling Commission, only 300 North Atlantic right whales remain alive today. Four fewer, I guess, thanks to the U.S. Navy. This last story is from the Globe and Mail about philanthropist André Chagnon, a 76-year-old Quebec businessman who just 4 years ago set up Canada's largest charitable foundation to fight child poverty in Quebec. The foundation clearly reflects the founder's personal beliefs. A vegetarian for the past 30 years, Monsieur Chagnon actively promotes the benefits of a well-balanced diet that excludes chemicals and genetically modified foods. And he persuaded the foundation's board to buy a chain of vegetarian restaurants called Le Commensal, with a vision of opening outlets in hospitals and schools throughout Quebec. The restaurants, which have yet to generate a profit, have also become part of another initiative to train and employ single mothers on welfare. And I like that. I like someone out there just doing good things all around. That's it for this week's news.
Rob, you're so funny.
I don't know why.
What? It's the way you shake your head sometimes when you do the news. That's just lovely.
I just love that.
Just lovely. We're going to come back. We're going to come back with Ray Vasudharan. I practiced saying her name with her last night. It was quite funny on the phone. She said, come on, say it with me. So we're going to hear from Ray Vasudharan about the campaign called Skinned, which is it's part of, well, that group is an animal protection group in BC that is was pressuring famous players to stop advertising for the Fur Council of Canada and for other independent furriers, and I'm sure this is just the beginning of much more fur activism that we'll see from them. But famous players did stop running the ads, so this is sort of a success show. We're going to find out more about what types of strategies they used and why they think they were effective. But before we do that, I think we want to talk just briefly about the forum and some of the other stuff that's going on with the website.
Yeah, we put a new forum up on the website so that our listeners can be more interactive with the show.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask questions to our upcoming guests. You can post suggestions or ideas you have for the show. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about in the coming year on Animal Voices and what's important to you.
And you can also say the stuff you don't like.
You can.
If there's things you
don't
like.
If there's anything
at
all.
Or you feel like there's things that we're missing. I also just wanted to give a quick heads up about next week's show. If everything goes as planned, we're going to get Josh Harper on the line, and he's going to talk to us about veganism and anarchy and the intersections he sees between the animal rights movement and the anarchist movement. So that should be really interesting. I don't think we've specifically tackled anarchist theory before on the show.
And the website, since I don't think we mentioned it, is www.animalvoices.ca. And the forum is there, and all of our archived shows are there and everything as well. So
yeah, we've been able to archive some of the shows quite quickly lately, thanks to Neil Harvey. Just a quick shout-out and thank you to him. We have the Ravi Shand interview, which is the one about he's a military guy who is also vegan, and he converted to
the corporal Marines. Animal rights guy.
Yeah, and we also have Lester
Friedlander.
Yeah, and he's on... he's on the program as well, talking about mad cow disease and some of the problems with the current animal agribusiness in Canada and the United States. And we also have the burnout show, which was quite a successful show, and people wanted to know about that. So that's about how to avoid activist burnout, and that was with James Strecker and Mayan Park from Compassion Over Killing. But I think we have Ray on the line right now. So we're going to go to Ray from Skinned. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
I know that it's very early on the coast right now. So I always think our West Coast activists are so dedicated. You got up early. So tell us about Skinned and what you all set out to do in that campaign against famous players.
Okay, well, I started Skinned 2 years ago to deal with the fur advertising at famous players. And we're a grassroots group. We campaigned for 2 years to rid famous players of their fur advertising, and I believe we have influenced them. There was a pattern there for about 3 years where the theaters were being, well, famous was advertising for the Fur Council and independent furriers for about 3 years from about 2000. And this year we've noticed that there are no fur ads at the theaters, and hopefully our campaigning efforts influence them. Our campaign generated 9,000 emails of complaint against their fur advertising. So, you know, with that kind of negative public feedback, I think they put ethics before profit.
So you think it was more than just a coincidence that they stopped running them this year?
Yeah, I hope so. I'm pretty confident it wasn't just a matter of economics.
And was your group in contact with famous players directly, or was it just through the email campaign? Like, did you contact anybody in the higher echelons of famous players?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it wasn't strictly through email.
It wasn't strictly through email.
And what was your dialogue like with them? Were they open to what you had to say, or did they just completely shut you down?
Well, for a long while, they weren't responding to the people who had written in. I think they were so overwhelmed with the mail that they got. But eventually, you know, they were open to a dialogue with us.
And so what, just so I can get a vision of what this advertising looked like, it's,
yeah.
You know, famous players, it's a corporation, the
right.
Canadian corporation, I guess. I don't know, maybe they have affiliates with the U.S. or they're part of a larger U.S. corporation, but it seems strange that they would do advertising for another company. What did that look like? Did they have, like, pictures of Brad Pitt wearing fur to advertise their movie, or?
No, what it was, you know, when you go to the movies, they show you about, 8 or 10 minutes worth of advertising before the movie starts.
Okay.
It was part of their pre-show ad lineup.
Hmm.
It was a 10-second still for different furriers in BC, Ontario, and Quebec. So some of the ads had the logos for the different furriers, and some of the ads had the logo for the Fur Council of Canada.
Hmm.
And from my understanding, the Fur Council of Canada approached Famous and bought an advertising package for their members.
And how are you able to mobilize, you know, all these people to send out these emails? Just for the activists who are listening and want to know how you waged your campaign, we'd just be curious to find out more about the mechanics of that. How did you get in touch with people and get people motivated to write Famous Players?
Well, what we did is we really took full advantage of the internet, and we sent out our alert to virtually every animal rights list, and we picketed religiously every Sunday outside the theater.
Mm.
And we gave out something like, what was it, 32,450 leaflets in 2 years.
Wow.
And we collected 4,000 petition signatures. We went at it tooth and nail. You treat it like a job, and you just cover all your bases.
It's funny, I've been at some anti-circus protests, and people always scream at us, get a job! And it's funny to say, well, this is my job right now. Thank
yeah.
you. So tell us about why you're so passionate about raising awareness and targeting famous players about the fur industry. I assume you're don't like the Fur Council of Canada, obviously, and
right.
The independent furriers that they were supporting as well. So tell us about the fur industry and why you're so angry about it.
Well, the thing is, the fur industry, I was concerned that they were using the theaters, because what they're doing right now is they're trying to influence a very young age group. And Famous's audience is young. It's between the ages of 12 and 26. That's a very impressionable age group. So that was our main concern, and that's why I focused our attention on that. And I've always had very strong feelings against fur. I mean, I think it's one of the most despicable animal industries. It's brutal, it's frivolous, it's completely unnecessary. You just can't justify this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I focused on it. And the other thing is, the whole fur issue has sort of become marginalized in the animal rights movement. No one is working on it full-time apart from the fur bear defenders here in Vancouver. So, you know, that's why I felt an urgency. And the fur industry is trying to make fur popular again through fur trim. And, you know, they're busy deceiving the public by making real fur look fake, you know, by dyeing it and shearing and all the rest of it. They're targeting, you know, their marketing campaigns to our youth. And typically, that age bracket wasn't really around for the strong anti-fur messages of the 80s and the 90s. They're still very young. So they're very vulnerable. So those are the reasons why I just work on this issue.
It seems that the fur industry has, it's changed the strategies over the years. And one of the things that they've done, in addition to, you know, promoting fur trim or dyeing it different colors so it doesn't look like fur, is that they've really, and I think this is something that's been happening for a while, but they've really played up the myth that if you're against fur, then you're against Indigenous hunting practices, and that to buy fur means that you're supporting First Nations people in Canada. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very happy to see... We had a lot of Native people sign our petition, and the majority of Native people see this industry for what it is. And it is completely against Native culture to kill animals for fashion. So this is not a part of Native culture. The fur industry likes to use Native people, and that's all they've ever done is use them. I had Algonquin Wolf Native people sign our petition. I had Cree people sign. I had Diné sign. I had Kwagoose people sign. I had Shuswap First Nations people sign. I had Tsilcotin people sign. They see this industry for what it is. It did them in culturally and socially. It has never helped them in any way.
So if the fur industry is not necessarily about people out on the ice and supporting their Indigenous practices, what does the fur industry actually look like? If you were going to tell somebody a brief introduction about what does the fur industry look like, what does it mean for animals now? Could you talk a bit about, let's say, fur farms and how the animals die?
Yeah, well, fur farms are the worst side of the industry. Most people sort of know about the trapping in a sort of vague way. A lot of people haven't even seen what a leg hole trap looks like, but a lot of people just don't even know that fur farms exist. And the bulk of the fur in the world on the global fur market comes out of fur farms. Two-thirds of it comes out of fur farms. Only one-third comes out of trapping. It's the fur farms that are more worrisome. I mean, the trapping is still barbaric, but the bulk of the production comes out of these fur farms, and most of these fur farms are located in Europe. 60% of the global fur production comes out of the European Union, and most of it is concentrated in Scandinavia. A lot of people don't know that fact. Canada's contribution to the global fur trade is actually quite minuscule. It's about 5%. So when I talk about the state of the fur industry, I like to highlight what's happening in Europe, and a lot of momentous change is happening in Europe for the better. Fur farming is steadily collapsing in Europe. Huge, huge changes. For example, England, Wales, and Scotland have banned fur farming. The last fur farm closed January last year, and we're going to see the end of fur farming in Italy by about 2008, because higher animal welfare standards are coming into effect. Austria, the last fur farm closed in 98. Denmark banned fox farming in 1989. There's also movement in Scandinavia, which is very important because I mentioned most of the fur production is concentrated there. Sweden banned fox farming in 97 and is ripe for a total ban on fur. Next couple of years, they've tried to vote on it this fall. but there are some people in the government who are stalling. But it looks hopeful. Switzerland, there are no fur farms because fox and mink and are considered wild animals, so they're protected. And Russia has become a fur importing country, and Norway fur farming has declined by 43% over the past 5 years. So there are huge changes happening. So I think the glass is half full, not half empty.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the animals that are used? Then do we have a sense of the global numbers of how many animals are in fur farms right now, or how many are killed per year globally?
Yep, there are about 40 million fur-bearing animals that are victimized of this industry every year. The backbone of the fur industry is mink and fox. It's about an 80-20 split, 80% mink, 20% fox. And then, you know, you have the trapped animals like the lynx and the bobcat and wolverine and so on. But the bulk of it is mink and fox.
There's on the website www.skinned.ca, there's quite a graphic image of an animal that looks like he's being killed.
Yes.
He or she is being killed. Can you tell us about what's going on in that shot?
Yeah, that's a fox puppy. The fox pups are killed at about 9 months of age when the coat is prime. And foxes are typically electrocuted through the anus. They've also started electrocuting them through the vagina, and these are all legal methods approved in Canada. They're approved by Agricultural Canada, so this is not something that's illegal.
This is really standard industry practice, then?
It's standard industry practice, and the reason why they electrocute them through the anus and vagina is so that they keep the pelt intact. You know, the integrity of the pelt is the fur farmer's main concern, not the welfare of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one method. There's gassing. A lot of people are in the impression that gassing is better. It is not. Like in the case of mink, mink are semi-aquatic animals, so they will try and jump above the gas line. And so they don't die immediately. And a lot of fur farmers won't use gassing techniques because it discolors the pelt. So they use things like neck breaking. Neck breaking is common with mink. They also use pesticides as well.
Hmm.
Any method that doesn't hurt the integrity of the pelt is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the code of practices that this industry has in place are voluntary. So the fur farmers can use even worse methods if they want to.
Right. Ray, we're going to have to close the interview, but I wanted to thank you for being on the program today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
And I wanted to just give people the website, www.skinned.ca, and you have a form that people can fill out just to send a quick thank you note to famous players to say thanks for stop running the fur ads.
That's
just
right.
To keep pressure on them to continue with that.
Yeah, we hope their disassociation will be permanent. So if people can send in a quick thank you, that would really help.
Ray, it's great to have you on. Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for bringing the fur industry back onto the radar for the animal rights movement in Canada.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye now.
That was Ray Vasudevan, and she was talking about the Skinned campaign that, I guess that's the name of the group. That group in BC has been working on to pressure famous players to stop running their fur ads, and famous players, I guess this year, has stopped. So that's a success, which is always great to hear. We're going to hear a little bit of music, and then we're going to come back with Pradeep Kumar Nath, and we're going to hear about his efforts with the Visakha SPCA in India and the tsunami disaster relief. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore and Lamia Teking today. We were able to connect with Pradeep Nath Kumar, and I just want to say thanks for being on the program.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine.
I'm glad we were able to contact you today. Can you tell us a bit about the Visakha SPCA?
Visakha SPCA actually was formed in the year 1996. We have been catering to services for both the domestic and the wild animals. We are on to various projects like the animal birth control for the street dogs, and then cattle protection, and sea turtles protection, and the migratory birds. Besides this, we have this mobile ambulance services. And so far we have been quite progressive in making the animal birth control. We have done 21,000 dogs in the city alone, and now we are extending the program to the rural areas.
Wow.
And in this, regard also, we have been able to totally stop the poaching of the sea turtles and the dolphins, which they used to poach for baiting, for the catching the sharks. So this is what we are doing.
Tell us about your efforts then to help with the tsunami disaster and the animals that were affected.
Actually, in India, the worst affected is the Andaman Nicobar Islands, and then you have the Tamil Nadu coast, then the Pondicherry, Kerala, and Andhra Pradesh. So we are actually located in the center of Andhra Pradesh state, where about nearly 500 to 600 kilometers, the waves have come inside and has damaged. That is about 6 districts. Much of the domestic animals have been affected, but not the wild animals, because the wild animals had the sixth sense to get away. But also here, the domestic animals, especially the ones that are left free, they have been able to escape, especially the dogs. They had the sixth sense to tell the people and to run away. But those that were tethered, I mean, they were tied to the poles, they have perished. And in AP, as per the statistics, 163 cattle have gone. And as our third team has says that about 40 goats have died so far. And we have covered nearly 500 kilometers. Another 130 kilometers is still left to be done.
I think that a lot of people who have been following the tsunami disaster and its impact on animals and people are under the mistaken impression that all of the animals were okay. And it's important that that your group is doing what it's doing, because obviously there's other animals that were affected. There's a quote from one of the websites that you posted on that you said, how helpless these beings were, not even given a chance to try to flee the sea's fury. So there's obviously still a problem there. When you are encountering animals that are in need of help, what kind of conditions are they in right now, and how are you helping them?
Well, actually, you know, what we are trying to do is we're trying to see the animals. Actually, our situation locally, which I would like to mention here, is that when the water has started to come inside, the people had fled from their homes, leaving behind their pets. Some of the pets have lost their owners. So we are trying to go around trying to pick up these pets. So likewise, in the villages, actually, you have these also these scattered dogs or abandoned dogs. But one thing in the Andhra Pradesh coast, that where we are located, is that human lives have not been that much damaged. Human lives, there is, of course, about 160 to 200 people have died, they say. But these people actually are not from the affected village coast. These people are visitors who had come on that particular day to pay some religious obeisance to the ocean. You know, in the full moon day it was. So in a Hindu religious culture, that was a thing. So most of the deaths that happened here were related to the people who came to visit. And so... yes, it is true that the animals had the sixth sense to escape, but the pets and the domestic animals like the goats and the cattle have been a little bit affected. And for this, what we are trying to do now is that those that are saved, we would like to feed them, abandoned ones, and those that, supposing the cattle and the goat, especially the goat population, we are trying to give what we call vaccinations. And we are taking this opportunity to bridge the gap between the people and the animals, and we are trying to see that we try to do the animal birth control in that area, and also try to do the free veterinary camps. You know, it's a long-term project that we are now aiming at.
Tell us about the ABC program that you've been involved with.
The animal birth control, actually, we have started in the city, and we have already covered 70% within 4 years. And we are also doing to the cats also, the ABC program. And we are now extending to nearly 2,000 villages. That means covering about 40 to 50,000 dogs. And we are the only organization along the entire coastal belt of AP, which is the largest in India. That's 1,000 kilometers. And we have recently tied up with another organization because, we are doing the sea turtle protection. So sometimes when the sea turtles are attacked by these beach dogs, creating a big problem. So we have been able to convince the authorities that we should not kill these, you are not supposed to kill these dogs, because we have a law in India that you cannot kill dogs but do the animal birth control. So we are taking up this to the entire coastal village in AP and also adjoining Orissa state also, where the lakhs of Olive Ridley turtles comes there for nesting also.
Mm. And how have your veterinary bills been so far? How expensive is it to do the work that you've been doing in general, but also, I guess, specifically with the tsunami disaster relief and helping the animals?
Actually, we at the time of tsunami, our shelter vet had left to Chennai because his parents were located there. But so we had started to ask for veterinarians to come to help us immediately with our team. Looking at the conditions that he had, and then afterwards, after some time, he came back because his parents were safe. And then meanwhile, we had a veterinarian from Boston who's still over here, and she's going to leave on Saturday, and she's trying to help us in future and also presently with the animals that have been saved. She's trying to condition them, streamline all the animals, because we have more than 700 different kind of animals in our shelter. And at the same time, what she's trying to get us with is that in future, we should be ready for what are the priorities for the disaster management relief. And also she's helping us to do the post-vaccinations programs, which our fourth team is also going down to Nellore.
And is your funding through the government of India, or is the funding just purely donations?
Presently, we are getting donations from outside, nothing from the government as yet. But we hope to. We have put a petition to them to help us with that also. But it's still to come.
When we tried to contact you last week, you were at the shelter, and you mentioned that you have many different animals there. Is the shelter able to hold all the animals right now adequately with all the animals you've been trying to help, especially with the disaster?
Yes, we have about 2.5 acres land where we have about 500 cattle, and then accommodation about 60 to 70 dogs. And so we have about 6 monkeys, 8, 9 tortoises, and about birds are about 9 are there. So we are able to adjust over there in that 2.5 acres land.
And are there other humane societies in the area where you are, or other ones in India that you've been able to connect to in terms of coordinating efforts?
Yeah, but we don't want to burden them much. Because we would also like to help. We are trying to coordinate with the vets who are able to ask us so that we try to send them to the downs, Tamil Nadu coast and in the Pondicherry and in the in Andaman Nicobar. Also to Sri Lanka also we have been diverting some of the vets and all. Because here we are one organization from the north, Animal Health Foundation, did say that they wanted to send a team. But, it didn't come. They did not come to us. But most of them have gone down south.
Mm. Pradeep, thank you for being on the program. I just wanted to let people know that are listening, if you want to donate or find out more about this group, you can just go to our website, www.animalvoices.ca, and we'll post information about how you can donate there. Pradeep, thank you for being on the show, and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. That was Pradeep Kumar Nath, and he is. We were able to connect with him, which is great. He is calling from, or we were calling him. He's located on the east coast of India, and he's involved with the Visakha SPCA. He's actually the founder and president. And we're going to come back after a short musical break with Leslie Fox, and she's going to tell us about the dissection alternative program that they've been running, called Frogs Are Cool, which is mostly a support group for students who want to resist dissection in their schools. Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's jump right into it. Tell us about the program, Frogs Are Cool, and why you've been a part of setting it up and what you hope to accomplish with the group.
Well, Frogs Are Cool is basically a website. It's www.frogsarecool.com. And it was set up by a wonderful woman on Victoria Island who is a graphic designer. And the website is essentially a resource center and also a support base for students, mainly young people, high school students, facing dissection. It's a place where they can get a lot of great information about the alternatives and post some of their comments and feelings about dissection on our discussion forum. The reason why I took this campaign was because my high school experience with dissection was a traumatic one. In grade 11, I dissected a fetal pig as part of my biology course, and that was my very first experience with dissection. Mm-hmm. And the whole time, you know when you're doing something wrong and in the pit of your stomach and it just all of those whole feelings, and I didn't feel empowered to say anything at that point. I grew up as an animal rights person. However, I didn't kind of find my voice until about sort of towards the end of high school. So that experience was a pivotal moment for me, and it really made me think about my ethics and what I wanted to do, and I think was part of the process in me building up that confidence, you know, to where I am today to speak out about issues affecting animals. And in grade 12, I continued with biology because I was interested in the science, and once again, the issue of dissection came up. This time it was frogs. But at that point, having gone through the experience with the fetal pig, I knew that there was just no way that I could do it again. So I approached my teacher, and I was sent to the library to do research. And it wasn't that big of a deal, and I think I remember getting a reasonable mark. But what I learned from the experience was alternatives do exist. The teachers just don't tell you. So now that I'm older and I have, I think, more of a wider understanding of the issue itself, I want to use my voice to help young people who maybe aren't quite there yet, and, you know, they just could use a friend.
And so are students then concerned sometimes that they to approach the teacher, or is the major issue just not knowing that there are alternatives?
I think it's a combination of both. I don't think it's naive to assume that there are teachers that are clearly in favor of dissection who present themselves to be in favor of dissection, and that could be intimidating for a young person to approach them and ask for an alternative. And another part of the problem, and sort of, I guess, what's most confusing with this issue is most teachers already agree that if a student does not want to dissect animals, they will be provided with an alternative. But the problem is, though, is the students don't know that. And there is nothing in writing giving them their options and choices. So what happens a lot of the times is I think students perceive dissection to be part of the course. Mm-hmm. You know, the teacher puts down the tray with the dead animal on it, and this is what we're doing today, this is the assignment, and that's sort of it. And there's no discussion, there's no talk of alternatives, and there's no really, I don't think there's an effort being made to get students to really think about how they feel about this and make a choice that's good for them.
Are the animals always dead? I mean, when I think about dissection, I certainly have the image of the pig fetus, but also, you know, of the heart still beating with frogs. Does that still happen? Are all the animals killed first?
No, I don't think that there are animals that are alive. I mean, it is possible. I'm assuming it probably depends on, you know, the lesson that's being conducted. My experience with dissection, and from what I've heard in comments, most of the animals are dead.
Can you talk a little bit about the alternatives that are out there and whether or not, I'm assuming for some people listening, they're saying, yeah, but there's just some things you can't learn with a model. So tell us about the alternatives and tell us about why you think they're better.
Oh, I'd be happy to. With the alternatives have certainly come a long way, and even from when I think, you know, we've been in high school, technology has advanced so quickly, and there are CD-ROMs that are available now, Digital Frog, Tangent Scientific, ScienceWorks, those are the names of some companies that create them. And basically, what the CD-ROMs do is they provide essentially a hands-on experience, again, with students, this interactive way of learning. And students can go to the images and click on various parts. We'll use a frog for this example, and remove different layers of tissue through the computer, remove organs. And what's interesting with the CD-ROMs, in terms of advantages, students have to repeat the exercise until they get it correct, whereas if you make a mistake using an animal specimen, well, the specimen's ruined and you can't go back and fix it. Also, the student's knowledge is tested every step of the way, and they need to show a grasp before continuing. All of the information is right there on your screen. The organs are listed, what their function is. Well, you know, obviously, you can see where they're located. The programs can be edited. And I think one of the best advantages about using the software is it can be used year after year after year. So alternatives, frankly, save money, and they lower costs for the schools. Animal specimens are one-time use, and each year, you know, they need to be purchased for each pair of student, for each class, in each school, and it can add up.
Mm.
Other alternatives besides the CD-ROMs, there's anatomical charts, plastic models. You can get the 3D replicas of animal species, transparencies, or even just good old-fashioned library research. I've had really great comments from students that would go to the library and just really do a thorough investigation of the animal specimen that the class is studying at that time. I mean, whatever alternative is used, we're talking about high school students here, and it's my belief that high school students obviously need to learn about biology and anatomy and physiological components and all of those things. And I think that can be achieved at that level of education, what we're talking about, again, high school, through these alternatives. I think that's a great, great idea.
Are there some schools who have really caught on to the idea of alternative methods?
I think it's growing. Even in a city of Vancouver, I know we're struggling with this campaign now to make a student choice policy. The trustee I've been working with mentioned there are schools in this area that have the CD-ROMs. The problem, though, is the students aren't aware of that. No one tells them that schools have them. So I guess it's sort of hard to say what the schools have already, and just because, again, we need to create an open dialogue of what's available for these students. So, yeah, I guess it's sort of anyone's guess what the schools already have, but if they have them here in Vancouver, the CD-ROMs, I'm sure they're everywhere, and they're really accessible to get. They're easy to get. So,
Leslie, this is a really hideous question to ask you, and I feel compelled to do so. A lot of people listening might just say, well, they're just frogs, you know, or it's just a pig fetus. It doesn't really matter that, you know, why should we care about that?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously, I care about every species, and, you know, there's the old animal rights saying, you know, a frog is a cat, is a pig, is a horse, is a dog. Like, you know, it's specious to, you know, not respect one animal and respect another. But I think the major thing what we're talking about is what's learned. What are we teaching students about animals? What are we teaching students about animal rights or valuing life when we give them these animals pumped full of chemicals and have the students tear them apart and tear their bodies apart? And I think students are really uncomfortable with that idea and really leave the exercise feeling just a blatant disrespect for life. And I think that's really damaging to their psyche, you know, when they grow older. And I just think that it's just certainly setting them up for a long road ahead.
And where are the animals coming from that are used in schools?
Most animals come from the biological supply companies, also pig fetuses from slaughterhouses. Some frogs are known to be taken from the wild, others are raised in captivity. Animal dealers, animal shelters, there's a variety of sources.
I want to make sure that people have your website and also for students listening to know about some of the resources that they can access.
Definitely. Well, our website, again, is called frogsarecool.com, and you can go on it, and there's all kinds of different pages you can click on, and facts, questions and answers. There's some detailed information about the alternatives available, There's also a part where we call it Your Say, and students can post their messages and literally speak out against dissection and kind of get practice for it through our website. And also there's some contact information for our group and information about our campaign here in Vancouver. So we're actually asking for people to write letters of support to the Vancouver School Board, and there's information on our website about how to do that. Again, it's frogsarecool.com.
When we talked briefly last night, you said, you know, this is really an issue that's relevant to all Canadians. Can you tell us why it's not just a Vancouver issue, or why you made that point to me?
Certainly. There is only one small community in Canada that has a student choice policy, and that's in South Shore, Nova Scotia. So if Vancouver passes a student choice policy, that means hopefully, you know, we'll be raising the bar for the rest of Canadian cities and, you know, inspire some people along the way. And hopefully this will pick up a trend. And a student choice policy is very basic. What we're talking about is a student choice policy is just basically a policy that says in writing if a student doesn't want to do dissection, they don't have to and will be provided an alternative. So it's nothing radical that we're talking about here. So it's something, it's actually a very winnable campaign, I think, and something that's very proactive. And, again, we're encouraging our fellow activists to speak out about things that they don't agree with and be empowered and help animals. And we need to really think about young people. And I think a lot of us as activists are older, and dissection isn't something that we're really dealing with anymore because, you know, kind of been there, done that. But I think that we need to think about how we can help young people and inspire them to speak out for animals.
Leslie, great work. Thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
All about empowering youth, it sounds good to me. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Next week, we're going to talk about veganism and the animal rights movement and its relationship to anarchist theory. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner. Thank you for listening.